Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Bob Saldick. I'm past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. I will be your moderator for tonight's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Amartya Sen, Nobel laureate, professor of economics and philosophy at Harvard, author of the new book, The Idea of Justice. Let me give her a brief introduction to Professor Sen, which he probably doesn't need. He has 7 pages in Wikipedia. Dr. Sen received the 1998 Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences for his work on welfare economics. He is currently the Thomas W. Lamont University Professor and Professor of Economics and Philosophy at Harvard University. He is also a fellow at Trinity College and University of Cambridge, the first Indian to head Oxbridge College. He is known as the Mother Teresa of economics for his work on famine, human development, welfare economics, and the underlying mechanisms of poverty, gender, equality, and political liberalism. His books have been translated into more than 30 languages. He has an unbelievable number of honorary doctorates. He is a trustee of Economists for Peace and Security. With great pleasure, I introduce to you Professor Amartya Sen.
I must first apologize to the assembled crowd here for my inability to judge how long it takes to come from Stanford to here. An estimated hour turned out to be more than 2, so with traffic, so my apologies. But with that, I must say I'm delighted to be back again at the Commonwealth Club, and I would like to thank the chair, Mr. Saldich, for his very kind introduction. The title is Search for Justice, and that's what I'm going to talk about, and it's draws a lot from my last book, The Idea of Justice, which is published by Harvard University Press a few months ago. Ludwig Wittgenstein, the great philosopher, wrote in the preface to his first major book in philosophy, Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, published in 1921. I quote from Wittgenstein, "What can be said at all can be said clearly, and whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent," unquote. Wittgenstein would re-examine his views on speech in his later works, the very austere view that he expressed there, which I quoted. But it's wonderful that even as he was writing the Tractatus, the great philosopher was marvelously and admirably inconsistent and did not always follow his own exacting commandments. In a remarkably enigmatic letter to Paul Engelman, written in 1917, Wittgenstein said, I quote, "I work quite diligently and wish that I were better and smarter, and these both are one and the same," unquote. Really, one and the same, being a better person and a smarter guy. It's very tempting to ask, who is Wittgenstein kidding? I'm, of course, aware that modern American usage has drowned the distinction between being good as a moral quality and being well as a comment on a person's health. No aches and pains, fine blood pressure, and such. and I have long ceased worrying about the apparent immodesty of those of my friends who, when asked about how they are, reply with manifest self-praise, "I am very good." But Wittgenstein was not an American, and 1917 was well before the conquest of the world by vibrant American usage that has so enlivened the world. So what was this pronouncement about? Underlying Wittgenstein's claim, maybe the recognition in some form that many acts of nastiness are committed by people who are deluded in one way or another on the subject. It has been argued that some children carry out odd acts of brutality to others, other children or animals, precisely because of their inability to appreciate and understand adequately the nature and intensity of the pains of others. There is perhaps a strong connection between being antisocial and the inability to think clearly. We cannot, of course, be really sure about what Wittgenstein meant. It's an enigmatic letter. My friend Tibor Makan has an interesting paper on speculating on that, but it's really hard to decide what he was meaning. But if what I presented is what Wittgenstein meant, he was in the powerful tradition of European Enlightenment that saw clear-headed reasoning as a major ally of making societies decent and acceptable. The leaders of thought in the Enlightenment did not, however, speak in one voice. In fact, there is a substantial dichotomy which had not received sufficient attention, I would argue, between two different lines of reasoning about justice that can be seen among two groups of leading philosophers associated with the radical thought of the Enlightenment period. One approach concentrated on identifying perfectly just social arrangements and took the characterization of quote-unquote just institution to be the principal and often the only identified task of the theory of justice. This way of seeing justice is woven in different ways around the idea, the powerful idea, of a hypothetical quote-unquote social contract, an assumed contract that the population of a sovereign state is supposed to be a party to. Major contributions were made in this line of thinking by Thomas Hobbes in the 17th century and later during the period of Enlightenment proper by John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and Immanuel Kant, among others. The contractarian approach has become the dominant influence in contemporary political philosophy, led by the most prominent political philosopher, and indeed the greatest contemporary political philosopher of our time, John Rawls, whose classic book, A Theory of Justice, published 1971, presents a definitive statement of the social contract approach to justice. The principal theories of justice in contemporary political philosophy, whether we think of Rawls, or, you know, who was a very close friend of mine and a great influence on my life, and many other friends of mine who write on the subject, Ronald Dworkin, Robert Nozick, a very close friend, alas, dead now, David Gautier, Thomas Nagel, have basically followed this line and have drawn in one way or another on the social contract approach and concentrated on the search for ideal social institutions, identifying that as the principal task of the theory of justice. With that approach, I intend to disagree, but I would at the same time want to emphasize that there are all strong influences in my thinking, in particular Rawls, and I think to a great extent it's contrasting my understanding of it from that very big approach that I can identify what is it that one should be looking for in a theory of justice? The book, I might say, my book, Idea of Justice, is dedicated to the memory of John Rawls, and I think there's a reason for that. But we have to note that even within the Enlightenment, as I mentioned, there is another tradition. A number of other Enlightenment theorists, very strongly Adam Smith, Marquis de Condorcet, one of the theorists of the French Revolution, Mary Wollstonecraft, radical thinker in England, I think a major author who's even though she is clearly recognized as the first feminist writer, I think the reach of her writing has not been fully appreciated. And later on in the 19th century, I'd put in this category also John Stuart Mill and Karl Marx. They took a variety of approaches, differing from each other radically, but shared a common interest in making comparisons between different ways in which people's lives may go, jointly influenced by the working of institutions on one side, but also people's actual behavior, their social interactions, game theoretic or non-game theoretic, and other factors that significantly impact on what actually happens. The analytical and other mathematical discipline of social choice theory, which can be traced to the works of Marquis de Condorcet, whom I referred to earlier in the 18th century, he is the great classic founder of the work, but which has been developed in the present form, revived and developed and reshaped under the leadership of Kenneth Arrow in the last century, belongs to this second line of investigation, in which I must admit I've been very much involved myself. I spent quite a few decades of my life working primarily on social choice theory. And in a sense, the book is an attempt. It's a mathematical discipline. The book is not full of maths at all. There's, in fact, no math. But it's that general philosophical approach that goes with that mathematical approach that I'm trying to develop in this book. I argue in that book that to address questions about the enhancement of justice and the removal of injustice in the world is the principal task of a theory of justice. That basically, since this is not a detective story, I can give you the theme away. That's really what it is about. In this alternative approach, we don't begin by asking what would be a perfectly just society, what would a perfectly just society look like, but asking what remediable injustices could be seen on the removal of which there could be a reasoned agreement. That is an agreement if people are willing to reason. Of course, as many friends of mine, including Anthony Appiah, recently argued that I overestimate how many people are willing to reason, and whether or not I do, that's a different subject. But I want to make clear, I'm not saying that they would necessarily agree unless they reason, but I'm arguing that on the basis of reasoning, you can have an agreement, which is what I'm trying to outline. So that doesn't require me to assume that everyone reasons. And if they don't, then that's not what is being discussed. One of the limitations of the social contract approach to justice is the unjustified conviction that there could only be one precise combination of principles. And despite its implausibility, that assumption is needed for the social contract approach to justice, which takes its job as identifying uniquely a combination of ideal social institutions. And no such unique identification could be made unless there is a clear choice and priority of principles, and we're ending up with just one set of priorities. It is, of course, important to scrutinize critically all principles that are presented for our attention, and some will undoubtedly get rejected after a searching, reasoned probe. But the claim here is that even after reasoning, more than one competing principle may actually survive on the basis of their reasoned justification. That is, there would be that reasoning would reduce the acceptability of principles, but even among the acceptable principles, you will have more than one, which would compete with each other, and in some cases allow you to arrive at some decisions, and in other cases, and we ought to be frank about it, not. And that is the nature of the subject of justice. There's an example which I consider in my book, and I might briefly mention that here. This is a story of three children competing for a flute. One child demands it on the ground that she alone can play the flute. The others have no clue how to play it. Others don't deny it. Another child demands it on the ground that he has no other toys to play with. Well, others are extremely well supplied with massive lot of amenities. This, again, is not denied by the others. And the third claims it on the basis of the fact, which others don't dispute, that she actually made the flute with her own labor. None of the claims are immediately dismissible, and a just arbitration has to weigh the claims of all these competing grounds. And in some cases it may clearly emerge, in other cases not, and when it emerges, it won't be because some principles are simply not so important. It is on grounds that, given the magnitude of what is involved in somebody's creativity, or given the magnitude of what difference it makes when the flute player can, who knows how to play the flute, can play the flute actually, or how much deprived the second person was, you may, taking into account quantities as well as qualities, arrive at a conclusion. But no mechanical priority of one ground over the others is convincing, and sometimes even at the end, an element of arbitrariness may be left in decision processes in general, of which this may well be an example. Thanks to this plurality of surviving principles, we may not be able to resolve on grounds of justice alone all the questions that may be asked. For example, whether a 40% top tax rate is more just than or less just than a 45% top tax rate. And yet we have every reason to try to see whether we can get reasoned agreement on removing what can be identified as clear injustice in the world, such as slavery or the subjugation of women or extreme exploitation of vulnerable labor, which so engaged Adam Smith, Condorcet, and Mary Wollstonecraft, and later Karl Marx and John Stuart Mill. Their focus was different. Marx more about exploitation, John Stuart Mill more about liberty. Mary Wollstonecraft, Condorcet, Smith, particularly involved in the abolition of slavery. And their focus were different, but each of these, we could see, they might be able to argue with others about the priority, about wanting to do those things without in any way disposing of issues connected with other injustice that remain. Or today, we could be similarly concerned about gross medical neglect of the bulk of the world population through the absence of medical facilities in parts of Africa or Asia, or a lack of universal health coverage in most countries in the world, including, as we know from the debate that's going on even today, the United States of America, or the prevalence of torture, which continues to be used with remarkable frequency in the contemporary world, sometimes practiced by the pillars of the global establishment, or the quiet tolerance of chronic hunger, for example, in India, despite the rightly celebrated abolition of famines. Different kind of failing, and doesn't get enough attention at all. I've so far been discussing the subject matter of public deliberation on justice. There is also an important question about participation. Who are the participants? Whose voices should count in interacting public discourse on the demands of justice? In the social contact tradition, the views that must receive attention have to come from those who can be seen as parties to the social contract. Given the country-by-country and nation-by-nation structure of social contract, powerfully identified by Thomas Hobbes and pursued in mainstream contemporary philosophy, indeed that is the mainstream theory of justice, the contractarian tradition tends to confine discussion to members of a polity or a nation, in particular the citizens of each country, who are engaged in deciding on the ideal institutions and corresponding values for that particular sovereign state. The need for impartiality in the treatment of different citizens within the country are accepted and celebrated, but there is no secure place in this formulation of deliberations of justice to go beyond the citizens of a particular state. If this can be called closed impartiality, as I do call it in my book, where impartial consideration is confined to the citizens only, it's impartial, but only the citizens are involved, we can contrast this with Adam Smith's insistence in his theory of moral sentiments, but also in The Wealth of Nations and in his lectures on jurisprudence, on the necessity to pay attention to the views of people from far as well as near, which can be called open impartiality. This is fully developed in the theory of moral sentiment. Last year was a kind of anniversary. It was published 1759. So 2009 was the 250th year, quarter of a millennium since the publication of the book. And there is a new, I shouldn't be advertising various books, but there's a book, new edition of the Theory of Moral Sentiment, where I have a long introduction discussing the continued relevance of Adam Smith to the present world. Smith thought that impartial consideration, which must be essential for justice, demands that we go beyond the boundaries of each state. There are two principal grounds for requiring that the encounter of public reasoning about justice should go beyond boundaries of a state or a region. And indeed, that's what Smith spelled out. I'm following here Smith's line of reasoning. One, the relevance of other people's interests, which may be affected by what we citizens of a country do, that is, other people other than the citizens. And two, the pertinence of other people's perspectives and understanding to broaden our own investigation of relevant principles for the sake of avoiding our own parochialism based on the values and presumptions in the local or national community. The first ground, related to the interdependence of interests, motivated Adam Smith to chastise, for example, the injustice of early British rule in India in the 18th century. And when Warren Hastings was impeached with a speech by Burke, which is often remembered, but Smith's writings on the East India Company is often not so remembered, though they were very strongly critical, and he ends up by saying that describing that rule, that the rulers who have taken over are utterly unfit to govern any territory whatsoever. In today's interdependent world, it is easy to appreciate the need to consider the interdependence of interests and whether we consider the challenges posed by terrorism or by global warming or by the world economic crisis that we are currently experiencing. Confining our attention to national interests only cannot but be the basis, cannot be the basis of understanding the demands of justice. Also, AIDS and other epidemics move from country to country and from continent to continent. And also, on the other side, the medicines developed and produced in some part of the world, like in America, are important for the lives and freedom of people far away, for example, in Africa. In addition to the global features of interdependent interests, there is a second ground, that of avoidance of the trap of parochialism for accepting the necessity of taking an open approach to examining the demands of impartiality. If the discussion of the demands of justice is confined to a particular locality, a country, or even a larger region than that, like a bigger entity like Europe, there is a possible danger of ignoring or neglecting many challenging counterarguments that might not have come up in the local, regional, political debates or been accommodated in the discourses confined to the regional culture, but which are eminently worth considering in an impartial perspective. Smith was particularly concerned about avoiding the grip of parochialism in jurisprudence, so it figures not only in the Theory of Moral Sentiment, but also his third book, Lectures on Jurisprudence, which was published posthumously on the basis of his notes in the University of Glasgow, but about the same time delivered as the Theory of Moral Sentiment. And it figures, of course, in the Wealth of Nations, too, but the Theory of Moral Sentiment is a big place where it does. In a chapter in the Moral Sentiment, which is, I think, revealingly entitled, I'll read out to you the title of the chapter, On the Influence of Custom and Fashion Upon the Sentiments of Moral Approbation and Disapprobation. So the influence of custom and fashion, how they affect our ideas of morality. That's a chapter. Here Smith gives various examples of how discussions confined within a given society can be fatally limited by parochial understanding. And here I'm going to quote an example. One of the interesting things to remember about Smith, that when he is giving any example of cultural limitation, he never chooses societies that in the contemporary debate in Britain at that time or Europe are regarded as not so good. For example, I mean, in the East, that is the attitude. He discusses negative features, say, for example, India and China, including foot binding in China. But he doesn't come out with as strong a denunciation as he does when he comes to ancient Greece and Athens. There's a line of reasoning on grounds that people don't feel that they're immune to it, because if Athenians could fall for it, well, then, my God, anybody could fall for it. I guess that is the reasoning behind this approach. So I quote from Smith. The murder of newborn infants was a practice allowed of in almost all the states of Greece, even among the polite and civilized Athenians. Uninterrupted custom had by this time so thoroughly authorized the practice that not only the loose maxim of the world tolerated this barbarous prerogative, but even the doctrine of philosophers, which ought to have been more just and accurate, was led away by the established custom. And upon this, as upon many other occasions, instead of censoring, supported the horrible abuse by far-fetched considerations of public utility. Aristotle talks of it as of what the magistrate ought upon many occasions to encourage. The humane Plato is of the same opinion, and with all the love of mankind, which seems to animate all his writings, nowhere marks this practice with disapprobation, unquote. Well, Smith's example of infanticide remains sadly contemporary today, though only in a few societies. Some of his other concerns have relevance to many other contemporary societies as well. This applies, for example, to Smith's general insistence that, I quote, the eyes of the rest of mankind must be invoked to understand whether a punishment appears equitable, unquote. Scrutiny from a distance may be useful for practices as different as the stoning of adulterous women in Taliban's Afghanistan, selective abortion of female fetuses in China, South Korea, or parts of India, and plentiful use of capital punishment in China, or for that matter, in the United States. Incidentally, the numbers are quite sobering of the 2,390 executions in the last year reported, 2008. The biggest was in China, 1,718. So China is top in the league, second Iran, third Saudi Arabia, and fourth the United States. It's a peculiar company for the United States to be in, I might mention here, in this context. The relevance of distant perspectives has a clear bearing on some current debates in the United States. For example, that in the U.S. Supreme Court not long ago, and indeed some of it's still going on the appropriateness of death sentence for crimes committed in a person's juvenile years. The demands of justice being seen to be done, even in a country like the United States, cannot entirely neglect the understanding that may be generated by asking questions about how the problem is assumed in other countries in the world, from Europe and Brazil to India and Japan. The majority judgment of the court, Supreme Court, as it happens, ruled against the use of the death sentence at that time for a crime that was committed in juvenile years, even though the execution occurs after the person reaches adulthood. You wait for the person to become adult and then you execute him or her. Though the judgment would have been different today, as we know from what Chief Justice Roberts, who was not then in the court, has already said, he's made clear which side he would have been on in that debate. So we know that instead of 5-4 in favor of that, it would have been 4-5 against it. In denying the appropriateness of capital punishment in this case, the majority in the Supreme Court did not simply, and I hear a quote from Justice Scalia, as he diagnosed it, simply defer to like-minded foreigners. I don't think that's what they were doing. Scrutiny from a distance can be very useful to avoid a local parochialism for reasons that Adam Smith analyzed in order to arrive at a grounded judgment, taking note of questions that consideration of non-local perspectives can help to generate. It will never settle a question. You'll never follow another country. But you ask some questions, and in this case, why is it that in Europe that would be regarded as absurd? And indeed, capital punishment itself would be. It's a question. It's a Smith's advocacy is question mongering rather than answer presenting. And in fact, I believe the entire enterprise of the theory of justice has to learn something from that. It is about reasoning, how to bring in the relevant questions that one has to be concerned with. It's important to recognize that listen to distant voices, which is part of Smith's exercise of invoking the impartial spectator, does not require us to be respectful of every argument that comes from abroad, not at all. We may reject a great many of the proposed arguments, and sometimes even all of them, and yet they would remain, in particular cases of reasoning, that could make us reconsider our own understanding and views by taking into account how the analysis has been done elsewhere, linked with the experiences and conventions entrenched. That is, going beyond the experiences and conventions entrenched in a given country or culture. The interdependence of reasoning is part of the ground on which Martin Luther King Jr. said in a letter from Birmingham jail in April 1963, I quote from King, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere," unquote. Active public agitation, news commentary, and open discussion are among the ways in which the pursuit of global justice can go on, even without waiting for the global state. Those who have taken the contractarian view, including very powerfully my friend Thomas Nagel, have argued the idea of global justice is a chimera in the absence of a global sovereign state. But that is indeed the Hobbesian position. That's not the Smithian position which I'm trying to argue for. The challenge today is the strengthening of this already functioning participatory process. There's a long way to go, but it exists. And on which I believe it's on that strengthening, the pursuit of global justice will, to a very great extent, depend. I would argue that this is not a negligible cause, nor is it beyond our reach. Thank you. Do I stay here? Or?
You stay right there.
Okay.
Our thanks to Amartya Sen, Nobel laureate, professor of economics and philosophy at Harvard University, the author of a new book, The Idea of Justice. And now it's time for our audience question period, and we have a lot of questions. First one I'm going to ask you is this one. Why do the words bring to justice today often imply punishing or killing the offending party? Is this an appropriate use of the word justice?
You know, I'll be a Smithian, and my book quotes Smith from saying that there are many different ways in the word justice is used, and don't try to arbitrate between them. They all have place in the language. But define your own understanding fully. I think that use of bring to justice, meaning penalize, is a possible use. That's not the subject matter that is either with my book, Idea of Justice, is concerned, or for that matter, Rawls, Dworkin, Nozick, any of them are concerned. They're justice in a broader sense, which also exists in our language, and indeed, I would say, exists in a very big way in our language, namely, how to think about justice in the world. And that's when people say that we seek justice, that's not we are seeking penalty, but we are actually seeking a world in which we see injustice removed. That's really what we are pursuing, I think, here.
There's several questions about the current political situation in this country. Let me read a couple of them. In the United States today, our national political leaders cannot seem to pursue the common good due to the pursuit of their own self-interests. Is our system thus devoid of justice?
Well, you know, I speak here as a professor at Harvard. I remain an Indian citizen, so I mustn't chastise American politics. But to the extent that that diagnosis is correct, and I haven't expressed a view as to whether this is correct or not, that would clearly be an impediment to the pursuit of justice. That is easy enough to agree. But I leave the American citizen to decide whether indeed they would be right to think that their political leaders are basically pursuing their interests rather than justice. And I think I've put on record that I've expressed no view on this subject at this time.
Let me ask an Indian question then. Justice has two components, law plus execution of law. India has law to protect women against social injustices and violence like rape. However, women do not have refuge in law. A woman is blamed for being raped. Where and how can women find justice in a country where law is not enforced and a society does not prioritize?
Yeah, I think what goes wrong here is a very useful question to concentrate on, is what one of the main messages of my presentation is. The social contract approach is looking for a perfectly just world, whereas the other approaches are looking, the one I'm trying to present, is trying to see how you could remove manifest injustice. To the extent that these laws are good, and I think they are, and they are not adequately enforced, clearly enforcement of it will be part of the pursuit of justice. The search for justice, which is the title of this talk, would include that. What is wrong in this is assuming that nothing has changed. After all, these laws didn't exist. Many of them didn't exist in the British period. Indeed, the British period, there was even a law which made homosexuality a criminal offense. It's only last year, in a movement in which I was involved too, in my general capacity as a citizen, this was ultimately turned down by the court. And that is a change. And I think having more sensible rules about rapes and from whom you can take evidence. And as you know, in many countries, the evidence for rape cannot come from the person raped, which is, I think, a terrifying situation. That's not the case in India. That's an improvement. On the other hand, the execution of that law has improved over the years, but it's still very, very far from where it should be. So I think it's possible to say in a world of theory of justice that I'm trying to present, what the position is, that we have been able to remove some of the injustices involved here, but many of them remain. And I think the question points to what would be one of the ways of pursuing that. And I'll go further, that even the law requires refinement in certain respects, making it easier to give evidence, and not women fearing that they may get involved in some other charges if they try to take their own course in seeking justice in the sense of, in this case, bringing, in the rather narrow sense, in which the first question raised it, namely trying to penalize the rapist in this case. So I think there are all kinds of ways things could be improved, but I think the big thing to do is not to make the enemy, not to make the best the enemy of the good. At the same time, not to stop only at the good by saying, well, now that we are good, we don't want to have to worry about the rest. We ought to try to get there. So I think it's that combination of thought, namely to celebrate any achievement and yet seek more achievement. It is that approach, a comparative approach. And if there's anything in the social choice theory that I was trying to present, it's based on the idea of a ranking, of an ordering. Sometimes a partial ranking, you may not be able to rank everything. But when it's quite clear that reasoning of justice demands some changes to be made, and this will be such a case, I think there's a very strong case to pursuing that in that light. So it's actually a very useful question to illustrate the point that I'm trying to make.
An audience member has read your book, and he or she questions the origins of justice. Quotes from the book, you quote Charles Dickens, who says, in the little world in which children had their existence, there was nothing so finely perceived or finely felt as injustice. And other writers have written that children around the world have a sense of what is fair. In all languages, we hear children say, that's not fair. Is that something built into the human psyche?
Well, what I did say in that book, it's really only the first sentence of the preface. I was warming up, I might say. I said that for children, the idea of fairness and justice is very important. I would go on to say, but so it is for adults. And that's the context in which I was mentioning it. Now, do children have a sense of justice and fairness? Yes. Are they invariably right? No. And I think that's what reasoning is about. I think my friend Dieter Sklar, who was a professor at Harvard but died some years ago, used to mention that it's very important to recognize that a sense of injustice is very often the beginning of an exercise of reasoning of justice. And I think that point is very important here. And I think children have a very strong sense of justice, and the reasoning still remains. Now, I don't know whether it's a hardwired into it, into our mind, that there's a sense of justice, but it certainly seems to be prevalent. I try to refrain from the point of view about biological evolution and how that came selected, because ultimately it doesn't matter how it came to be selected. It does matter that it does interest people. And I think then we ask, should justice interest children? Should justice interest adults? The answer is yes. And if I can get an adequate answer, I don't have to ask the question, is it biologically hardwired or not? I just don't know.
You are, in addition to being a philosopher, you're also an economist. So let me ask you a couple of questions. Many questions from the audience about what's going on in this country now. What legislation or regulation do you think would really change the moral behavior of banks and other large corporations? Another one, how do we understand justice in the framework of, quote, happiness of the greatest number? Does it ever need reconsideration? I ask this in the context of the health bill. Is this bill just? What is your stand? Another one, I always felt that health and health insurance should at least be nonprofit. It doesn't seem right or justified to make exorbitant profits based on another person's pain and suffering. How do you think about all these kind of economic and philosophical questions?
Well, that's quite a
handful.
First, with the banks, I think I would make two points about that. An institutional theory of justice, like that of Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, Kant, going all the way to Rawls, is concerned only with institutions and not with behavior. I'm concerned very much with behavior, too. And one of the reasons, not the only reason, why I think the contractarian approach is wrong is that the strategy is to have ideal institution, then it assumes, since these ideal institutions arrived at in the social contract, we know what the ideal behavior is, and we would assume that people will follow it. I think that's an absolute non-starter in pursuing justice. So if the questioner is concerned that behavior is a very big part of the pursuit of justice, he or she is right. And I agree with that. And that has been very much a distinction which I didn't invoke in today's paper, since I was trying to confine the timing to what is available. That in Indian legal theory, for a very long time, over 2,500 years, there's a distinction between niti and nyaya. Niti is justice in the sense of ideal institutions, ideal rules. And the Hobbesian-Rawlsian thing is very much a niti-based approach. Nyaya is realized justice. How did people's lives go? And that is concerned with as much with institutions as with behavior, because how people's lives go depend on it. Even when that Charles Dickens quote, when Pip is complaining about his sister, long time ago, had been very unjust to him. He's not complaining of the institution of family. He's complaining about the behavior of his sister. So I think behavior has its own role. That's my first remark. And the second remark, and by the way, it's also changeable. That is, it's not the case that behavior don't change. One of my glorious moments or ridiculous moments, perhaps you might say. I was an advisor of the Italian Parliament in what was called the Anti-Mafia Commission. It's the only time I've traveled with three policemen in front and three behind when I went to Sicily. But they were concerned with corruption. And one thing was quite clear, how the corruption of culture, a culture of corruption, can be emulated easily. And once you start changing that, and how quickly a vicious circle can be turned into exactly the opposite of that. That's the one point I'm still making. Second point is that I don't think the banker's behavior has changed very much over the years, but what changed were the regulations. There was absolutely no reason for the kind of deregulation which began actually from Reagan, President Reagan's days, but pursued as much by Democrats, including in the Clinton administration, as by Republicans, including some of the big changes, like credit default swaps, that is terrifying the banking system in the world. They are insurances at a time when there is a catastrophic failure. And to call them not insurance and exempt them from insurance regulation is one of the reasons why trillions of dollars at one stage were being insecure. People didn't know what it stood for. And I think quite a lot of it in this case was regulational failure rather than behavior failure only. It allowed people to take a kind of risk which is not necessary to take. Smith discusses that in the Wealth of Nations, and he says that we live in a system where it is easy for people to pay very high interest, borrow money, and then actually use it in a way, if they're lucky, will make a huge amount of profit. And if they don't succeed in making the profit, they can get away, walk away from it. That's not a very good incentive system. And he mentions, as part of Smith, that people don't seem to read that what you need is regulation to deal with that. And I'll take the same view. The second question was happiness of greatest number. I do argue why happiness is not the only way of thinking about it. Being healthy is a very important virtue. Even if you manage to create unhappiness, even in the state of ill health, that doesn't eliminate the ill health. It's quite an important point, because when people are ignorant of the curability of a condition, they are often not sufficiently grumbling. If you look at the Indian states, the highest longevity is Kerala, which also has the highest level unhappiness about healthcare. And the lowest longevity are Bihar, which also has the highest level of satisfaction with existing healthcare. So I think we have to move away from the Benthamite calculus there. But yes, otherwise, looking at the way the lives of people are going, the Naya perspective, that's certainly very important. And finally, since you had three questions, I'm trying to read my writing. Can you give me a clue what was the third question?
No.
No, you can't? Well, then I think... what? Oh, the healthcare, yes.
Oh, right, thank you.
Yeah, and profit-making insurance. I would say that actually the way it turns out, profit-making insurance companies have a huge limitation for giving all the wrong incentives, as has been discussed even by economists like Paul Samuelson, Kenneth Arrow, with whom I had lunch today. I was reminding him of this argument that he presented in 1973 and how relevant it is today because of the asymmetry of information and the informational need that the insurance companies may have to exclude people who most need insurance, and profit-making cannot eliminate it. But we have to do it not on the basis. I think the person asking the question said, my inclination is that profit-making cannot be right. That, I think, is probably the right conclusion. But in order to arrive at that, you can't just base on institution. Quite a few people also had a similar idea that basic necessities of life must not be produced by profit-making but by the state. Well, that didn't prove to be a very robust thought. In fact, quite often, profit-making companies make better use of it. And to just think about the debate in India when people were wondering whether allowing private companies to come into the telephone. And I have to say that the improvement that has been made by competitive profit-making telephone companies, great. So it ultimately one has to see how things work out. And that is the approach of NAIA. And that's what I'm trying to pursue. And it's very far away from the NITI, either of the Hobbesian kind or the classic formulation is the Ferdinand I, Holy Roman Emperor, who said that we should pursue justice even if the world perish. I think that's a very non-NAIA view, because if the world does perish, there won't be much justice to celebrate in that world. So I would say maybe the conclusion is right, but it should not be based on a gut feeling. It has to be shown that that is indeed the case. Turns out that it's probably so.
We have a whole row of questions which basically say, what's the best way to organize society to achieve justice and fairness? So let me read a couple of them. One is, are you a relativist? What endures beyond culture? Is there still a right or wrong in your theory? How do we know what it is, and if not by reason? Another questioner, to what extent can democracy lead to justice? Is democracy the only path to justice? More generally, what is the relationship between democracy and justice? And finally, someone asks, Because we have to survive as Homo sapiens, isn't justice that which ensures survival of the fittest?
Just to answer these questions, first, no, I don't take the relativist position. I do think, and indeed I argued even in this lecture and quite extensively in the book, that criticism can come from one culture about another. Indeed, the whole debate about capital punishment on the infanticides, stoning of adulterous women, depending on where you take your pick, the criticism has come from elsewhere often, also inside, but also elsewhere. There's nothing wrong in making these criticisms. That is quite different from saying there would necessarily be agreement. But I don't think there would be necessarily agreement even within one culture. I think the barrier isn't that one culture thinks one way, another culture thinks another way, but people think very differently. Even in America, you have got extreme conservatives, and you've got extreme left-wingers. And, you know, that doesn't mean that America is split into 65 different cultures. So I think this idea of what goes wrong in cultural thinking is this idea that somehow we can follow each other, which is always a hard thing to do anyway. But we can follow each other within a country, but somehow not at all beyond the country. I think there is a problem, but the challenge is not, it doesn't arise as you cross the boundaries of one country to another. Democracy, yes, if justice is a matter of reasoned arrival at conclusion, then democracy in the broad sense, in the John Stuart Mill sense of democracy being governance by reason, governance by discussion, is indeed quite central, because it's by discussion as indeed the answer to my first to the first question that I gave also indicate that really central part of the exercise. Survival of Homo sapiens, survival of the fittest. You know, I think the trouble really is that the survival of the fittest is not a normative theory, of course. It is describing what happens in the nature. And sometimes we want to go along with it, sometimes we don't. But those, the person asking the question who thinks that if survival of the fittest is the thing to do, then Homo sapiens we both want to keep. That, I'm afraid, is not the case. If it emerges another species which are better suited than we are, then the Homo sapiens will be completely sacrificed to the altar of the survival of the fittest. Darwin is not a survivalist of any species. Indeed, Darwin gives us very little clue about the debate that's going on about extinction of species. I mean, that things get extinct in the Darwin system, and that's the way nature is. And indeed, I had a paper actually on that subject some years ago about why that it is. There's a huge amount to learn from Darwin, but not just ethics, because I think that context, the limitation of survival of the fittest, is very weak. Basically, what we try to do is that even when people are not fit, we regard it's just that we want to look after them. And that's why people are disabled. We don't think of exterminating them. We don't try to do the exercise of IQ testing so that the people who are not so intelligent, those tribes could be eliminated. We don't follow all the rapidity of the Nazi program and so on, which is very much based on the idea of survival of the fittest, seen as a moral principle, and let the weakling go down under. I don't think there's justice in that. So I think that the last question is a problematic question. But, you know, these questions are so difficult to write down. I'm not blaming the questioner for it. If I had a conversation with him or her, I'm sure we would arrive at some position which is understandable to each of us. And that's, I think, one of the merits of discussion.
We have a few questions about religion. Let me try this one out. What has been and is the role of religious thought in influencing the prominence of social contract theory over social choice theory? Or what are your comments on religion in general as a force here?
Yeah. Well, I'm not terribly competent to comment on it since I'm not religious myself. But I think my attitude is pragmatic on that. There are many arguments that have figured in religion which I think are important and to pursue. I discussed, for example, in some detail from Gospel of Luke, Jesus' argument with the lawyer about the Good Samaritan, and mentioning, and I use that as a very powerful argument. People often don't take adequate note of exactly, including religious people often don't take adequately exactly what Jesus said. The Samaritan helped this guy, and the Levite and the priest didn't, though the Samaritan wasn't a neighbor, was far away, and indeed, by and large, despised by the Israelites at that time. So it's an unusual behavior. Jesus' question at the end wasn't whether the Samaritan did right and others did wrong. He didn't ask the question. He asked, what would the wounded person, who would the wounded person regard as his neighbor? And I think the answer to that was the Samaritan, and that the lawyer gives that. So I think what Jesus is trying to do there is defining neighborhood. Given the importance of it, as you know, one of the main things in the Gospels is that you have to learn two things, one, loyalty to God, and the other is doing good to our neighbor. But Jesus is qualifying that by extending the neighborhood in a very wide way. And I think this is a thought that comes up in the theory of justice all the time. And this particular idea may have a religious origin, but does not require me to accept everything else that's said, even in Luke. So it depends on, I'm not able to comment on it because a religious person might take the view that either you take the whole hog or you don't take any. So you can't what is the terrible term people use? Cherry pick your principles. But I want to do exactly that. I think the reasoning about justice is about that. And they may come from Buddhism, quite a lot of it does. I discuss Gita, the two points of view, which is the Hindu classic, arguing why Arjuna's position was quite a serious one, an important one too, not just Krishna's, which is the standard religious view. And similarly from Islam, the some of the things, oddly enough, actually, in terms of how it's portrayed often, the importance of tolerance that comes from some of the Islamic authors, including Akbar. And indeed, the hugely tolerant history of Muslim kingdoms in the Middle East, including tolerance of Jewish minorities and giving them an exalted position. So I think there's a lot to learn from the religious thought, but does that make religion the right thing? I think there I side with the Indian Emperor Akbar when he says that when choice comes to faith and religion, reason and faith, you have to choose reason, because even if you were to denounce reason, you have to give some reason as to why you're denouncing reason. And then he says that, yes, he was born a Muslim, he remained a Muslim, though he was doing all he could, and indeed enacted the first secular principles in the world about the state having to be equidistant from different religions, no matter what the religion of the emperor is. But his argument is that he didn't stay Muslim because he was born a Muslim. He stayed Muslim because he examined it, and reasoning did not give him any reason to change the position he had taken. I accept that. So I think if you put reason above faith, does that make you non-religious? I guess it does, in which case I am definitely non-religious. But if you have to put faith above reason, I think that's where the debate is, then I would need to see some argument as to why that position, rather than the one of Akbar, which I quoted, is correct.
A questioner says, in your book, you talk about Akbar a great deal, and the Indian emperor from the 1600s, a remarkable man. His philosophy evolved from reason, and he had the power to impose his sense of reason. He considered reason to be supreme. Who are the Akbars of today?
Well, I think there are many Akbars of today. I don't take a pessimistic view of the world. You know, people are arguing for it, and I think there are a lot of people doing just that. I think one of the things, I do complain that the world is full of injustice. I wouldn't be so engaged in writing a book on theory of justice that if that were not the case. And the one opportunity I had to address the Indian Parliament at the invitation of the Speaker, I spend my time discussing the injustices that exist in India, in addition to explaining what the demands of justice are. But at the same time, I have to say that we have to celebrate the efforts that go on all the time, some of which I've encountered because I've been very involved in a number of these movements. I was honorary president of Oxfam for 3 years and was very impressed to see how people would travel thousands of miles elsewhere trying to do things which they're not connected with. I see I've worked also closely with Médecins Sans Frontières, with the Human Rights Watch and so on. There are a lot of Akbars across the world today. I think, are they always winning? No, they are not. But that's not because there are no Akbars at all. Akbar was lucky. He was emperor. Well, he was not quite lucky. His father had lost his kingdom, and which his grandfather had built, Babur had built, and he regained the kingdom. But he did immediately proceed to do a number of things which was extraordinarily visionary, including, as a Muslim king, appointing at the head of the armed forces a Hindu, namely Man Singh. And it's absolutely extraordinary to trust an adversarial religious community with the leadership of the army. But I think what it showed is a level of maturity of thought which is very uncommon. Are there many Akbars in that sense? I don't know. There are some, certainly. I mean, I quoted one, namely Martin Luther King. I could quote others. I could quote Mandela. I could quote Gandhi. I could quote a few. I wish there were more. I would celebrate the fact. And if the questionnaire is beginning to agitate about more Akbars in the world, I'm ready to join him in that movement.
That's reassuring. Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question, and it's about the developed and the developing world. The developed world tends to view, according to this questioner, injustices in the developing world with a bias of assuming people in developing countries are less intelligent, less motivated, less moral, and that is why they are poor and disadvantaged. How do you foresee that bias being erased so that people begin to relate to each other's lives and struggles on a human-to-human level instead of the patronizing the poor attitude we face now?
Well, I think this is a very profound question, and I'm delighted you're ending at that note, because that attitude is far more common than people like to concede. And indeed, sometimes it comes in very explicitly in some cases. I can quote some theorists who have said that, and in great cases. Indeed, at the height of the Ethiopian famine, when Haile Selassie was emperor, he said that it's not surprising that lazy people would die of hunger. So I think people have all kinds of awkward statements that they make, and very often, recent years, that attitude has been quite common in the West. So I think that diagnosis is correct. I think it would be wrong to assume that that's the standard attitude. If that were the case, then we won't have some of the involvement of people in this country or Europe have in movements across the world. I think there is a lesson to learn from Smith as well. For example, the discussion I referred to Smith's critique of East India Company, but in order to put the context, he discusses why there are hardly any more prosperous region in the world than Bengal at that time. And to a great extent, that's right. I mean, there it's oddly enough, if you make comparisons of wages, what that could buy, it's amazing how little the difference is in England compared with India at that time. It can go either way. Now, I think what Smith's point is that you have to understand a lot more about world history. Learn, if you think about the basic ingredients of civilization, as Francis Bacon mentioned. He refers to printing press, which came from China. If you count that, I think 3 out of his 4 lists came from outside the West. I think there's a better awareness of global history is an extremely important thing. There's a kind of selective global history on that, and I think that plays a very big part in limiting people's mind. So I would like to say that I celebrate that question and point the fact that quite a lot of it depends really on knowledge of what happened elsewhere. Sometimes to have time for a one-minute story or not.
Absolutely.
Just to give an example, I gave an example of China and printing. If you take trigonometry, the word sign, which we use in trigonometry, what is its origin? The origin itself tells you something very peculiar. Aryabhatta, an Indian mathematician who first discussed these in great detail, talks about it, calling it in Sanskrit jya ardha. Jya is a diameter. Ardha is half radius. If you remember your school geometry, you will remember why sine is connected with that. Now, he shortened it later as jya. When the Arabs translated that, his book in 9th century, and their 8th, 9th century, and there were actually 2 or 3 translations of the 3 translations of that book, they translated it instead of jiba in jia into jiba. Now, as you know, Arabic, like Hebrew, doesn't have any vowels. So it's really a consonant, JV. You can pronounce it as jiba or any others involving JB. Later Arab authors, instead of calling it jiba, would call it jade, which is a fine Arabic word meaning a cove or a bay. Now, when 1150, Gerardo of Cremona translates that Arabic text into Latin. He translates jiba in Arabic into sinus, meaning bay or a cove in Latin, from which the word sign comes. So in that one word sign, you see a history of civilizational contribution varying from India, the Arab world, Italy, and then the rest of Europe, and the West, and then the world. So I think understanding of global history is dramatically important to prevent that attitude, and I'm really privileged that I get the opportunity to answer that question as my last shot in this discussion before thanking you all for listening to me.
Our thanks to Amartya Sen, Nobel laureate, professor of economics and philosophy at Harvard University, and author of the new book, The Idea of Justice. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, on television, on the Internet. My name is Bob Soldick, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you're in the know, is adjourned.